Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaga Nunanada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. Our guest today is Larry Amick Smallwood, who grew up in Ajimoog, the Lake Lena district of Mille Lacs. He has worked as a language instructor for the Minneapolis Public Schools, Neosing School, the Leech Lake Tribal College, and the University of Minnesota Duluth. Since 1999, he has served as the Director of Language and Culture for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you grew up and what people on the reservation when you were a kid in the 50s and 60s, what they did for a living.
Well, myself growing up on a reservation was, I never gave it much thought when I was growing up on a reservation. I mean, it's just a way of life. But, you know, we all had our communities, our different communities. And I lived off the main part of the reservation, probably about 10 miles away. But I guess you could say, or other people would say, we were poor. But we didn't know we were poor. I didn't think we were poor. I mean, you know, we had always had stuff to eat and money for food and things like that. Only thing is, the house that we lived in was a 22 by 20 one-room house with a stove and kitchen area in one corner and the sink and stuff in another corner, and then we had the back part for our beds, you know, and we had a large heating stove in the middle, no electricity. And I didn't miss it back then, so I wasn't used to it. If we wanted to watch TV, we went somewhere to somebody's house that had a TV, and 99% of the time it wasn't any other Shinabe's house. But I grew up in a farm community east of Sandstone, and would go visiting and watch TV there. And, you know, I always remember that old man always worked. We lived on a lake, and then next to that lake was another smaller lake, and it had about eight cabins between the two lakes, eight or nine cabins. And I know during the summer months, the old man would go to one cabin and clean it up, do the yard, and then maybe move on to another cabin and things like that. So he'd clean those cabins for those city folks. Well, they would come and they would pay him, like each one of them give him $10, $20, which was big money back then. So back then he was making, $120 a week almost, which was a good living, you know. But also he would help the local farmers out with the haying and things like that. So he was always doing something. And then also, one of the main occupations a lot of the men from the tribe would do was to be loggers. They would cut pulpwood, and they would peel pulpwood in the summertime. And in the summertime, when you cut a pulp log in 8-foot length and peel it by hand, you know, you were getting like 12 cents a stick for it. But in the wintertime, when they wouldn't peel it, they would just cut them into 8-foot lengths, and then they would get probably 6 cents a stick if they were lucky for that. And that's how they made their living. And so all of these local men would do that, be logging. There were some other occupations too they did during the summer months. A long time ago, I remember there were the bean fields. All the people would go camping in these different bean fields. And they'd camp on the edge of the field. They'd take a 40 or 80 acre field or however size it is, and they would pick by hand all these beans. They were given very little per bushel, but they made a living that way. They had enough to buy their food and their kids' clothes and their necessities. Then after the bean fields were over, well, then came the ricing on the lakes. They would often take these boats out and they would go ricing, and they would get hundreds of pounds. Well, then they would take the rice they got, they'd finish it, you know, and they'd keep most of it, enough for the winter for their families, and also some of the relatives that lived in the cities, they would give some to them. Then what they had left over, they would sell. And they had a lot of rice, so they made enough to buy fairly new cars and clothes for the winter. So it was good. And of course, those little guys used to help before we started doing those things ourselves, and we'd get a bag of candy and a dollar at the end of the week, which we thought was pretty good, you know. Then after that was over, then out our way there were the rutabaga fields. A lot of them would go out and harvest rutabaga fields in September up into whenever. A lot of our people, too, went to North Dakota, western Minnesota, to pick potatoes. They would go over there and pick potatoes. So there were always jobs, hard work.
Mm-hmm.
But we always had so. But yet, to other people, we were poor. You know, that's the way it was a long time ago. So the old man, they had plenty to do. They always had money. It was a good life.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit of Ojibwe. Like, what kinds of things would your family say, maybe to each other or to you, when you're in, for example, bean fields, rutabaga fields, potato fields? And the reason I'm asking is because, you know, as we're trying to relearn our language, us younger people, that's the kind of vocabulary that we don't always think of, and it's almost specialized. Like, a bean is an animate being. In English, it's just a thing, but in Ojibwe, it's animate. And same with potatoes. So on rutabaga, I don't even know what the word for rutabaga is. So,
Well, everything was in Ojibwe, of course, some guys. And there was a lot of words I forgot that they used to, but they were joking all day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Anishinaabe people, they joke, "Punny nuja kidog nuja I divog ko gagi kidog." Give me no one go see what. Give me no one go see what. Give pano kiyod. We go to go and go guys. It's chicken wag and but chicken. Give me no one go see what. Punny papi what. Imam we can je doad gay. Skeng yo give muskade some in the king. Give queen dan ko give pagabe shiang with a jirei but pashquag with a get tiganing. In the Chicago, the Chicago now, and you much good day, seven and you get canoe. I will canoe, I guess, get to the gakash get to the Bakuja Benad, the much good day, seven and gosh, no kid. He mama with Chigio cana. Then you go to Gummig, you go in Shanabe. Gay get the Shigo, you went to the Bamawa, gonna put in the boy, you should the Bamawa, Siog. No, on and gay, maybe Shako, give away Asia Mog. Given Shanabe Gago Giza Chigawad. Give Dawe and Nuago Giwashima on the Boggy Kikabe, Georg Minikamas and Gayard, Miss Norge Mosunian, Gima Mahat. In the show. Nagako. Oh, Gima Noom and the King. Gone we know. Stay to Gipaka Kunazino. Saga Egan, and Guingo de Winjabayan. When the kia and go, Quincy and me got canoe in the gig, you know. And it was like Eganon. Skeggy pie in our boy, Cogi, Pawab in the morning, Saga Eganon. I knew a piggy bakako sing, I knew a piggy geeshing, oh. He wow in the mardug. As you go, that's as you go, Basho, the manome in the king, mutiga pie, as you go, so what, Baba Kansaga Eganon, you go, Basho, what. Kanawab and Damuad Nils, like Egan and May the Shingo and Gujingo would not be watching. You say, ha, music, Kishing, a ham, babe, Ozig, Mishigo, Gishing. Me, that's a pig, can I got Paisum and Oom and the kid. Got a Kishi Tower, that's me, Yippee, Guasa, do what? Yippee bought 2 hours, do, Manuman. Mishma. Give me gush come what, bungi, ye shangay what, unagan and get 2 hours, ye say ma kay what, yogi kush get 2 hours, man, woman. Me guys, check it, man, so. And gil gishad gave in the nug, chumo kumani gishad gave in the nug. Me kunga paga gwaja martik nil shanabin, unna piggy gishiging o, unna piggy baka kunamang. Keep us in the wog, maybe shang gil in the shanabe, gago geek, kituad. Gaw in this noon gum is in the was, you wag, gay abbe. Me go in ending or chumu come on now. Or do spew gay gumigung. Me go gay knock on the gate. Remember a long time ago in the bean fields, man, everybody would go camp out there, and all the families would go camp out there. And they used to work with each other, these families. Anybody that was big enough to pick a bean off a bush and throw it in the bag was working. All the kids, you know, of course, like I said, we'd get a bag of candy and a dollar at the end of the week. But they all supported each other, too. There was a lot of humor back in them days. They were teasing each other. They were joking around, laughing. You know, and I think that's one of the ways we managed to survive all the hardships we've had was through humor. Hmm. Always laughing and teasing. Then I remember, too, when we would go out to these lakes and race. I'd go with my folks. I was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, whatever. Back then, the game wardens used to listen to the elders on our reservations, on ours anyway. They would come and ask one of the elders there, is the rice ready yet? Should we open it up? And the elders always knew. He said, nope, not yet. It's not ready yet. And then these old men, they would go look at certain lakes, different old men. Then they would meet. And they said, this one will be ready next week. This one will be ready for 2 weeks. Or this one's almost ready any day now, maybe in 2 days. And then the game wardens would come and ask them, guys. And then they would move, as it got closer, they would move out to that lake out there in their tents. And they would make camps out there, and then they would get ready. And then every morning they would go check. Finally, somebody would check it early in the morning and say, okay, it's ready. Get in your boats. Let's go rising. And the whole camp would come alive, and then everybody, 20, 30 boats would be heading out there, however many people were in the camp. They would go out and do the rising. And when they got back that day, they would dry some, and then they would parch it, thresh it, and then they would cook it up and put on a feast. Do a tobacco offering and put out dishes and give thanks for the rice for a good year. You know, they had good rice and hope they had have another year next year. Rice was really respected back then. And I have to say this, you know, I look around at some of our casino buffets and the hundreds or thousands of pounds of rice they throw away when the buffet closes each day is just awful. Mm-hmm. Even some of our powwows. A couple of years ago, I was at a powwow and they had an outside organization cook the rice and it was cooked so awful. I myself even threw rice away in the garbage, and I saw other people do that. And right now, this is going on back home here. I'm trying to get them to stop serving wild rice, but they don't want to listen. They'll keep asking somebody until somebody tells them, yeah, go ahead and serve it. And then, you know, that's what's happening to me right now.
That's what people do, though.
Today they, and yesterday.
They don't get the answer they want. They just ask somebody else.
Exactly. And what's the sense of us trying to say anything to them, you know, if they're not going to listen? Our rice is supposed to be respected, and it gets wasted a lot at the casinos and wasted a lot at our powwows. You know, little kids don't know how to treat wild rice because they haven't had the teaching yet. So they don't eat it. They parents toss it. Parents don't eat it up. They toss it. And now look what's happened to our wild rice here in the last few years. Mm-hmm. I know here in east central Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin, all the rice that was destroyed. Me guy kindo out and give me a manadug in the shonaja to in bapanada manil manum and or gay go, come go and Miss Guy should we have a kamagi pop about Panaduna Manum and Nongum. Miss Guy, I mean Gonji should we have a kama as you know my Gangego Gay Amagasino and Manum. So I'm hoping that they'll open up their ears a little more and listen. Mm-hmm. Pay respect for that rice. It's very valuable. It's one of the spiritual foods that was given to us by Manandu.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the interaction you had between the reservation community you grew up on and the non-Indian community in the 50s and 60s when you were growing up. You mentioned how your family's out doing labor for non-Indians. Mm-hmm. And how did that all work? Were things pleasant back then? Was there any kind of tension?
The area I grew in, that farm community out there, was really a nice community. I mean, the people were nice out there. And the farmers, you know, they needed help. So, you know, they knew a lot of the native people didn't have jobs, so they would, you know, just go ask one or two of them, can you come and help us do whatever? And they would. And they would get their little money too, you know. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, there was some shady goings on back then too with some of our storekeepers. I remember one storekeeper out there east of Sandstone used to add things onto the old man's bill. His math wasn't that good. So when somebody came from the cities and checked out his bills, there were always discrepancies in there. So some of these storekeepers were kind of shady, you know. But the farmers were pretty good to work for. They were respectful people. And as far as kids, too, you know, we used to play well together. And I have a lot of little non-Indian friends out there. Well, they're not little anymore. They're old men. And we got along beautifully, spend the night at each other's houses, you know, and things like that. But after I got into a bigger town and went to high school, the two towns that are 11 miles apart, there was a lot of racism. And racism still exists in those two towns, I know for sure. Because we were always looked down upon, you know. It was always them Indians from out there, you know, watch them. You know, you get watched so often and you get picked on so often, you're going to act different. And it was not good. Yeah, racism still exists this day, but you have to experience it long enough to recognize it. Little comments that are made, you know, and the looks you get, you know, and now everybody's anti-casino there. But, you know, the casino there has brought thousands of jobs to the non-native community that are employed at the casino, and they have benefits. If that casino were to shut down for anything, you're going to have a lot of people trying to go back on welfare or get some kind of assistance, and it's not going to happen. And, you know, with the state talking about open gambling in the state there, you know, that's going to hurt a little bit too, you know. But I don't want to get into too much of that. That's up to our tribal leaders to discuss, you know. I don't want to say the wrong thing here.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaga Nunanada, which is brought to you in part by the College of Education and Human Service Professions at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Nwayung Ojibwe Language Nest. Nwayung is an Ojibwe language immersion preschool program serving children beginning at 33 months up through the first day of kindergarten. All subjects are taught in Ojibwe Mo'in, and children are immersed in Ojibwe culture, language, and history. Nwayung operates Monday through Thursday, September through May. Full and part-time enrollment options are available. More information at 218-726-7547. So in the community itself where you grew up, you didn't feel like it, but you know, people were kind of poor and they had a harder time getting by. But do you think it was safer than it is now, like as far as walking down the street at night? The one thing I see in, you know, my own community, but you know, you kind of see this elsewhere too, is that people have more income, but yet in a lot of ways our community is it's not quite as safe as it used to be, even when people were really kind of poor. Do you think that's the case, or do you think or why that might be the case?
Well, in our native communities, I know a lot had to do with respect a long time ago. Our people were more respectful. Our children were taught respect. I mean, guys like my age, when I was really young, we were lectured to every day. Pani in the sugijik kagi kimigumin, ego ya masdu dawakin, ego ya bapnu dawakin, ego ya nigaakin, ego ya dajamakin. We were taught respect all the time. And that's not happening nowadays. Even some of the parents are disrespectful, and so the kids get disrespectful. So, you know, it's a lot more dangerous than it was back then. You know, a lot of times they used to leave their houses unlocked when they went someplace. You know, you can't do that anymore.
Nope.
I don't even go check the mail without locking my house. I had company one time come over to my house over there, and I left my garage doors open, so we're all visiting because my garage door faces the driveway. They left. And then I got back to doing what I was doing. I couldn't find my generator. You know, even in Minneapolis was a lot safer back then. A lot safer. We used to walk around all evening and people sitting out in the porches visiting, you know, kids playing with each other. Man, not nowadays. You can't do that. So,
speaking of Minneapolis, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, as you grew up as a young adult, going to the city and when that happened and if you had any experience with what was called the relocation program in the 50s and 60s.
You know, when, after all these hard times I had in these high schools with racism, you know, I finally quit school after I become old enough to quit school, and I went down there. It was in the spring, and I rented a room for $9 a week. And I went sodding in the sod fields, heavy, heavy work, long hours. And I met a lot of my homeboys from the res out there working in the sod fields. Everybody wanted to work. So we did that. It was hard work. A lot of the natives left the reservation to find work. Because a lot of these small towns, those little mom-and-pop stores, mom-and-pop hardware stores, mom-and-pop gas stations, see, the people that work there are family. See, and we couldn't get hired because they got their own family hired. So that's why a lot of us had left and went to the city. But it all worked out good. But then, you know, at one point the government wanted to have people leave the reservation so they could get rid of the reservations. They came up with the Indian Relocation Act. Now, when I got out of the military in 1970, I went back to my old job that I had before I went in the military for a period of time. But I decided to go to school, so I went down to the Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Minneapolis. And I said, I want to go to school. Well, of course, back then, you know, everybody wanted to be an auto mechanic or an auto body person or whatever. So I want to go to auto mechanic school. Wonderful. We'll send you anywhere you want to go in the United States. We'll pay for your apartment. We'll pay for your schooling. You know, we'll give you money to eat on. Oh, man, send me there. Where would you like to go? So growing up east of Sandstone, I said, man, I'm going to pick the biggest city I can think of. So I said, I want to go to school in Los Angeles, California.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he sent me. I took a train from Minneapolis to Chicago and switched trains and went across country to Los Angeles and started school there, auto mechanic school.
And they gave you the ticket?
Oh, yeah. Everything was paid for. I got a little extra stipend, too, for necessities, personal things. You know, it was good.
Hmm.
It was good. But came back, got a job, not as an auto mechanic, but teaching.
Huh.
So teaching at the university language and then also at the public schools. So I never did put my auto mechanic skills. So I worked there for about 8 years for the Minneapolis Public Schools. Then when the old man passed away, I moved back up here to his house and with my grandma, my mom. And that's where I almost starved to death. I got one job there, working for DNR, for $3.21 an hour. Get paid every 2 weeks. I had to work a month before I got paid. And it was really bad, you know, and I don't see how these people ever made it out there without working for anybody else, like the farmers or or whatever. So it was hard then. But that was the way it was back then.
The other question I was going to ask you going back to your childhood was, what kind of relations did you have in different Native communities, maybe Danbury, the community at Mille Lacs?
That was great. You know, I have family in Mille Lacs. My grandfather moved there back in the 40s, so he lived over. So going over to visit them was really great. We used to travel around and visit. Okay, we used to go to Hayward, had some powwows going on during the summers then, so we used to go over there. And then,
are you talking of History Land?
History Land. Who can forget History Land? Go over there and dance over there. And then also Mille Lacs had powwows, and we used to go over there and dance. But I like the way they talked in Mille Lacs, because there's a little difference in how they speak in Mille Lacs and how they speak back home, although it's still Mille Lacs Reservation, just 50-mile difference over there. So I imagine I sounded kind of odd when I spoke. I sounded more like elders, well, because the elders raised me.
Mm-hmm.
But over there, the younger guys were speaking slang Ojibwe, so I jumped right in and taught myself slang Ojibwe so I wouldn't look or hear sound odd, you know what I mean?
So what's an example? Like?
Oh, man. One time I was in the town of Onamia, and I was getting off the car, and my uncle said, Tuskus! So I jumped back, and a car just missed me. I understood what he said. He was using slang, Tuskus. What he was saying was, Giga de Tibazikus, you'll get run over. And I'm glad I was with him over there using his slang than somebody else from back home, otherwise I would have got run over. So, yeah. But, man, you know what? Growing up, we all spoke Ojibwe, and, man, we always laughed all the time and make Ojibwe sound really fancy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who can speak the best Ojibwe and come up with the funniest things, and it was all fun, you know. Even when we were, you know, we always had, there was always alcohol as one reservation, you know, and us young guys got into that. You know, you talk about respect. When us young guys were under the influence of things like that, we always respected people's homes and elders and everything, even though we were being dumb, you know.
Was there as much fighting?
There was a little fisticuffs, you know, but it was blew over at the end of the night, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people nowadays, they go and spray paint and ceremonial buildings and they break into different things. We never did that. We always respected those buildings. We had no business going in there. Mm-hmm. Our ceremonial building sat in there. We never bothered it. We went around it. Even people's houses, we wouldn't bother those houses. You ask about fighting. Well, yeah, you know, you did your share of fighting, but it was because somebody's stupid reasons, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of times guys would go outside and slug it out. Somebody would come in with a nosebleed. Somebody would come in with a ripped shirt. And by the end of the night, they were buddies again. Mm-hmm. They were talking to each other, or by the next day or whatever. There was none of this grudge that carries on for years.
Or people getting stabbed.
Right. Like we didn't want to get carried away and do all that things. You know? Yeah. It happened once in a great while. So not only on a res, everywhere.
Yeah. You said that at Mille Lacs they talked a little bit different, and maybe part of that was slang, but when you spoke to people from, say, St. Croix or Le Coup d'Orée, was there differences there? Or was it more pronounced when you talked to people from Mille Lacs?
See, Oshawa over here by the Wisconsin border, and Le Coup d'Orée and St. Croix, they all speak alike. They really speak clearly. Mm. And Mille Lacs does too. But I'm talking about the younger generation that likes to speak slang and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what we did. That was what I'm talking about, difference. Mm-hmm. You know, but St. Croix has a little bit of different sound. Their words are exactly the same as ours, but their, how would you say, their accent a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can tell a person from St. Croix and I talk to him. I mean, we all can understand each other, but yeah. I know where he's from. And a long time ago, we used to know where each other was from by the way we spoke, you know, but...
That's
not
one
anymore.
Of the things that, yeah, it's probably going away, huh?
Nowadays, second learners, they're all, you couldn't tell where somebody is from. And there's no accents. Hmm. They have a tendency to use an English accent when speaking. So that's the difference.
Mm. Plus, do you think, too, it's just the way that some communities are better with language, you know, have more language right now than others? I mean, if you're from somewhere, it's tough to go back, and you might have learned from somebody from a different community or from Canada, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, too, yeah. Mm. I think that they should I think they should pick an accent.
Pick an accent.
Well, do you want to sound like you're from Net Lake, or do you want to sound like you're from... Canada, or do you want to sound like you're from St. Croix? You know, well, you have your choice. Nashad the kid. Oh, miigwetsa.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our guest, Larry Mick Smallwood, for sharing his stories with us. This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanida. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of the program, visit the KUMD website at kumd.org and click on Audio Archives. Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanida is produced by KUMD and by the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG, program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes. Accepting applications for fall 2014 semester now through August. More information at umdmtag.org. Funding for Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida is provided in part by the UMD College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.